that we bring to the table is investor alignment in terms of investing in the funds that we run. The very global equity fund that you have in your hands now, we have $20 million of our own money in that fund. So that means we're pretty darn aligned. It's all very well and good for boutiques to be earning fees off of FUM streams. They're aligned to FUM, then they're not aligned to performance. We're aligned to both performance and FUM through that. We're long only, very benchmark and aware and high conviction, sort of 20 to 30 securities in terms of what we do. We've had a pretty decent run so far. We've been around for just over 2 years. That's all very well and good. Everyone in this room knows that's behind us now, so big deal. We think far more exciting is that the platform that we're able to build, and hopefully being very mindful of the square root case that Hamish argued in yesterday morning's plenary. So without further ado, I'll introduce Hamish. Hamish's bio is in the packs because he's on the plenary on the first day, so I'm not going to bore you with that, but he runs the Global Fund and he's the CEO of Magellan. So thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, and for people here on that microphone, thank you very much and thank you for coming. If people heard me speak yesterday, I was asked to talk about the square root case, and believe it or not, I actually believe in the square root case. That doesn't mean it's actually going to happen, and there are scenarios where it won't happen. But I believe in this room we really need to think about the case that it will happen and how do we actually prepare ourselves if that is a view of the world, that we could come out of this recession, and we are going to come out of the recession. In Australia, we don't have a good comprehension of what really has happened in the world. I describe in Australia, we have been beaten up with a feather duster. We've really been tickled. We came very, very late to this, and we don't really have an appreciation just how severe things got in the world. They got very, very severe in the world in the last 18 months. The world's financial system on two occasions, which I won't speak about today, virtually collapsed. And we went into a very, very deep recessionary scenario, which I believe, and I spoke about yesterday, I believe we are coming out of that scenario. What we are very focused is really what I call years 2 to 10. In the next 2 years, we'll have a bit of a bumpy ride, but we will come out of a recession. But what is the growth in the world going to look like? And what does it mean for portfolio returns, for index returns? What's it mean for asset prices? What does it mean for house prices? In Australia, I think that the scenario that we have gone on in the world could actually go on for another period of time. Eventually in Australia, our day of reckoning is going to come, and we're going to go through a period of much slower economic growth in the future. It's going to be higher than other countries because we do benefit from China. And when I talked about the tooth fairy in China yesterday, I was talking about the globe. We get a more direct impact from what's going on in China. China's just not as relevant to save the entire planet, but from an Australian perspective, it is good news. But there are a lot of issues in Australia that the world has faced up to, that we'll face up to at some stage. What I would say to you is that over the past 15 years, and this has happened in Australia, and probably it's going to happen for a little longer in Australia, the major developed economies of the world have been on a massive debt-fueled consumption binge, where economies have been growing very, very strongly and consumers have been increasing their leverage. They have been effectively spending more money than they earn consistently over a period of 15 years, and that is a massive, massive bubble that has built up in the world. And when the financial crisis happened, whole series of the provision of credit got shut off to this consumption bubble around the world, and the world came to a virtual stop. Australia didn't come to a virtual stop, but the issue that has been associated with this build-up in this bubble has been going on in this country as well for 15 years. It just happened that the crisis was so severe in other countries around the world, I think it's actually stopped this consumption bubble dead in its tracks in many economies, particularly in Europe and the United States and in the UK. And it is going to have a profound effect, in our view, on future economic growth and future equity returns and also on asset values around the world. I'm talking about real estate there. This is just showing what has happened. And I normally show a lot more economies, but I'm trying to simplify the message here. This is showing the ratio of household debt as a percentage of gross domestic product. And you can see in both our economies, and I've chosen 1991 because that was effectively just prior to the end of the last recession. So when we We had much, much lower debt levels when the world had its last major recession. And over this period of time, all our economies, and the UK is actually worse than the statistic, and Spain's very, very high, and many other countries of New Zealand sort of very, very high as well, we have geared up. So debt in the economy has been growing at a faster rate than the economies have been growing as a whole. That cannot go on indefinitely. Mathematics, these can go on for very long periods of time. This is 17 years where this has happened for. But eventually, this cycle has to stop in our view. And as I said, in Australia, it's probably going to go on for another period of time. This is showing you the ratio of household debt as a percentage of income. So not only has debt been becoming a much larger proportion of the economic output of our countries, but as a percentage of people's household disposable income, people have geared up themselves very dramatically over this period. And what I would say to you, the only way these major economies are going to go back on their growth paths of 6-7% nominal GDP growth, in our view, is to keep the consumers driving the economies by spending more than they earn for an extended period of time. I just cannot see that scenario where that is going to happen. Australia may come out and go on for a while longer, but eventually this will catch up even with this country. The rise in the unemployment rate in places like the United States, which went from 4.3 to nearly 10% now in a very, very short period of time, is a very severe shock on the psychology of an economy. And in Spain, you know, unemployment's gone to nearly 20% in that economy. Our unemployment hasn't gone up very dramatically, so I don't think we've had the shock yet to stop this cycle. What I think is important to understand what the consequences of this deleveraging can be is to actually look at the two major economies in the world where households have actually started to save for extended periods of time. And what I put on this chart is Japan and Germany over this period. And you can see here is Australia and the United States who have geared themselves up. And in Japan and Germany, effectively household debt flatlined. They stopped gearing themselves up in these economies for the last 10-plus years in these economies. So this is an example of an economy that starts saving and stops gearing itself up. And we have to remember, this is the largest and second largest export nations in the world. So during this period, these economies were getting a major benefit from exporting goods and services to places like the United States that were over-consuming. So, you know, I would argue that potentially the view could be worse if the world wasn't behaving as it was over this period of time. And if you have a look over those periods, and I mentioned these statistics yesterday when I was speaking, in Australia over the last 15 years, our GDP grew at 6.4% per annum, and the US grew at 5.3% per annum. I would say it has been greatly assisted by what our consumers have been doing in our societies over time, and people felt good about borrowing money. One, it was freely available, but asset prices and house prices and equity markets were all going up. Everyone felt richer, and interest rates were very, very low. So relative to your asset base, your gearing didn't seem to be getting out of control, but relative to your income, it was actually going up materially. But in Germany, over that 15-year period, GDP was 2.6%, and Japan was 0.5%. Over that period. They are massive gaps. And don't forget, these countries were running massive trade surpluses during the period with very, very large export industries. And you can see that is between 3.5 to 6% difference between our GDP growth. And I said yesterday, my tip is that over the next decade, GDP growth, nominal GDP growth in many developed economies around the world may well turn out to be 3-4% below what it's been over the past 15 years. Now, this is just a simple chart of showing economic growth much lower, the statistics I gave you. But if you actually start to think about what it can do to things like house prices, I know this is a very sensitive topic in an Australian room, but over this period, house prices in Australia went up 300%. In the United States, they went up at 200%. Australian house prices, that's a compound return of about 7.7% over that period. And in Germany, they went up by about less, it was about 0.4 of a percent in nominal terms. So literally German house prices for the last 15 years have not increased at all. Yet our house prices went up by 300%, and in Japan they declined by almost 4% per annum. So when the consumer stops leveraging itself up, you can have a dramatic turnaround in terms of what returns you can get on certain assets. Classes, and if people are putting into financial plans at the moment, obviously the house, the ownership of a house is a large family asset that people have at the moment. If you're assuming in the next 15 years to a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old heading to retirement, their house prices will go up at 7.7% per annum for the next 15 years. I think people are living in Alice in Wonderland type scenarios. I think house prices will go up again for the next 5 years in Australia because we have not had a big enough shock to stop this event that's going on in our society. I think in the United States we've actually had that shock. And I'm not predicting that house prices are suddenly going to collapse by 30%. What I'm telling you is they just may not do very much. And there's no reason in the world why house prices should go up by almost twice the average weekly wage. And that has happened for 20 years in Australia and the United States and in the UK, where house prices have been escalating much faster than wages have been growing. There is no reason in the world. We can get bad government policy for a while about allocation of land and planning permits and all sorts of things, but over extended periods of time, they tend to work themselves out. And that's simply just the chart of, you can see that you can't even find a year in Japan where house prices went up over that period. And look at Germany. Look at house prices over 15 years. It's just a flat line. And it just makes you think a lot about if we're really entering another world. I thought Bill Gross this morning was excellent. Maybe because he agrees with me or something. But I thought some of his points were very, very important. I spoke in the square root scenario that one of the real consequences is going to be lower economic growth. You saw the wide divergence in GDP growth. I'm not predicting we get to a Japanese scenario of 0.5% per annum. I think we are going to get positive GDP growth, but I doubt it's going to be at sort of 6.5 to 7% that we've seen in some of these economies in nominal terms over an extended period of time. And I also spoke yesterday that there were probably two other big events that are going to flatten growth going out. I think the consequences of rescuing us globally from this potential depression we may have had, and the amount of fiscal stimulus and the budget deficits we have around in the world, they are dependent, in order to get out of this problem, they're dependent on real economic growth scenarios about 4 to 4.5% per annum in order to get enough revenue in order to start paying off deficits around the world. I think those scenarios are pie-in-the-sky scenarios. I don't think we're going to get the rate of economic growth in order for the Keynesians to be right, that we inject money into the economies as a multiplier effect, growth starts taking off again. I don't think we've seen a scenario where this has happened simultaneously on the scale it's happened around the world, and we've got the other event that consumers are so highly leveraged. So I think growth is going to be lower, and therefore the governments aren't going to have the Keynesian free lunch here. We're ultimately going to have to pay this money off. These deficits are actually going to have to be funded and paid off, and unfortunately that probably means higher taxes in the future and lower government expenditures. And if we have that combination, what happens to economic growth? That takes money out of the economy by doing that. So, and there was a famous British economist I mentioned, David Ricardo of the 18th century, and he talked about the Ricardo equivalence, which he really talked about, that if you spend money today, society realises it has to be paid off tomorrow and you don't get the free lunch effect that the Keynesians believe in. And there's a big debate around the world. The Germans are very, very strong on this argument at the moment, as the French are. And, you know, they haven't been listening to the Obama administration, that all they should do is spend, and they're a little bit more concerned about that. And the other thing I mentioned is also Bill Gross had some very interesting comments about around what the central banks have been doing and the printing of money. And it's my view that ultimately they have to reverse the policies at some stage. You know, they are highly stimulatory. the policies they've got in place with almost zero interest rate policies at the short end of the curve, and they've injected massive amounts of money into the money supply at the moment. It's not actually gripping at the moment. Most of the money that's been injected into the financial system around the world has actually been put on deposit. It's not being lent out by the banks. It's been kept as reserve by the banks and been put on deposit with the central bank. So the velocity of money, I think somebody spoke about, I think Jonathan Payne spoke about, has come dramatically down at the moment. But eventually, if we start to get a recovery, velocity of money will start to pick up, and that's the point that the central banks have to start pulling it back out of the system, because if they don't, the inflation equation comes into play in our view. I think the central banks they'll allow a modestly higher inflation scenario because they know all this. You know, I'm not talking about anything. The problem I have, I'm talking about, is I'm almost talking about consensus opinion at the moment that I almost found quite frightening at this conference. I've been saying this for 18 months or 2 years, but most people have got the picture that this is a real risk. It doesn't mean it's guaranteed to occur. The world is a complex place. Consumers could get back on a binge, banks could start lending, everything could go right, and we could go through another period of gearing up. Eventually, this is going to correct. I think we're probably at the point of inflection in many countries where it is starting to correct. And as people have pointed out, there's massive imbalances around the world. And largely it comes through current account surpluses and deficits and who's funding the behaviour of different societies around the world. We are massively dependent on this country in the goodwill of foreigners. Our lifestyles are dependent on being borrowing massive amounts of money offshore. And although we get told all the time that Australia is in a very, very strong position financially, our gross foreign debt in this country as a percentage of our income is higher than the United States of America. And we don't realise that. We keep getting told that our federal government debt is a much lower percentage. But we're not adding the amount of money that's borrowed by our banks to fund all our mortgages. All that is borrowed offshore. So we have to understand that from an Australian perspective, we are in a similar position to places like the UK and the United States in terms of these savings imbalances that have been built up around the world. The question is what does this really mean if we're thinking about it? And I'll give you some illustrations of what we're doing. Certainly what we're doing isn't the only things people should be doing. And if I was managing money in a different way, I'd be doing something different, but I would be thinking about this world, and I would be trying to manage a scenario to deal with this scenario. And what I would say that if this scenario is not right, a lot of asset classes will do a lot better. Even what we're doing will do better than we think it's going to be doing, and I'll be the happiest person on the planet. But if we're right, we want to get returns for investors that are going to be highly satisfactory if a world turns out that you have very low economic growth in many countries around the world. I think real estate and equity markets, I think owning, it looks like a bit self-serving, but I think going to own an iShare on the FTSE or the S&P 500 or the Nikkei, I can't find any compelling reason in the world why you'd want to go and own those major indices over the next 10 years. And I know your asset consultants are telling you you should go put your money into international equities. I think blindly going to put your money into international equities, into those major developed world indices and just buy the index when the index, and I think Bill Gross said he was expecting, I think he mentioned 5% returns, he mentioned on equity was his number this morning. Well, do people really want to put their money into equities at 5%? I think most people at sort of 7 to 9 returns on equities. I think they're going to be lower. Of course, we're getting a recovery. From March, we got to very, very low levels. I'm not saying stock markets are about to retest their March lows. That was predicting a Armageddon type scenario occurring. That had sort of some depression style statistics in those numbers. So we've reflected a more realistic view of the world at the moment. But I'm asking where to from here. I'm not saying things are about to fall off a cliff by any segment of the imagination. I think Matt must have put that point about manager selection and everything else. You know, I'm not here to give an advertisement about that. What I do want to talk about is how we're thinking. Many people have talked about emerging markets, and we're sitting here in our style of managing money. We're wanting to absolute minimise risk, and I understand that emerging markets are going to grow at much higher rates over the next 10 and 15 years. I think what's going on in places like China
is absolutely real. Being exposed to commodities, provided you time the cycle a bit, exposed to commodities, I think, is exactly the right place for part of your portfolio construction. I wouldn't put all your money into commodities. I think that would be madness. But I would put some of it, and I think anyone who owns any Australian equities, you actually, believe it or not, have quite a lot of your money exposed to commodities. So we're saying is we want to do something that is genuinely, in a global portfolio sense, doing something different to you doing your Australian equities portfolio. So we are X resources in energy. We do not participate in those at all at Magellan. So we're really thinking about how, if the emerging markets are going to grow at much higher rates, how do we make money out of that? And our investment objective, even in this low-growth world, is over the medium to long term, is to do better than 9% per annum for people with low risk. So what every time I make an investment, I want to have a pretty clear view that I'm going to earn above 9% per annum in that investment for people who invest in our funds. I'm not trying to tic-tac against some index or beat the Nikkei or something else. I think that's a Muppets game. But what I do want to do is actually deliver a return that's going to work into your client portfolios that's trying to satisfy their savings needs. And they don't satisfy their savings needs by outperforming the Nikkei by 2%. They satisfy their savings needs with whether return's 3 or 10. That's what really makes a difference in the game. We have 50% of our fund allocated in a very unique way that's directed at the emerging markets. So 50% of our funds is invested in multinational, non-discretionary consumer staple stocks. But the ones we're invested in have very, very large exposures to the emerging markets. We're in businesses that we think are absolutely almost guaranteed to win in the emerging markets. If any of that you heard from Chris Watling or anything, if he's right that the emerging markets are going to continue to grow, we actually think he is right. And we think that these businesses that we've put 50% of the portfolio in, which is very counter to what people are doing at the moment. People are moving out of all the consumer staples and we're going more heavily weighted into them. And we understand in the short term we well could have an underperformance for that, depending on what we're doing the rest of the portfolio. We've got 50% in these in this part of the puzzle. This part of the puzzle, we believe the companies we have, their revenues are going to grow at twice world GDP growth over the next 5, 10 and 15 years. It is very, very difficult in equities to get into a low-risk proposition that's probably going to be twice world GDP growth. We believe we've put 50% of the portfolio in that in that area, and I'll read you a quote from Mutnar Kent, who's the chief executive of Coca-Cola, based in Atlanta, and he says, "Despite the current economic tsunami, what we see is a great future for our business because no matter which way you slice it and dice it, between now and 2020, there'll be another billion people who become urbanised, and there's going to be another billion people joining the middle class, and that translates into a huge opportunity." For Coca-Cola, drink some of the products; they're very good for you. As you can see on the top line, we have very, very selectively gone into some multinational businesses that are very well positioned in these emerging markets. So a lot of people were talking about commodities as the way to go into emerging markets. Some may buy an emerging markets fund. We want to have businesses that have very low risk of losing people's money, but are tilted very much of what people were talking about today, where the growth's going to be. Yum Brands, which is Pizza Hut, KFC and Taco Bell around the world, 50% of Yum Brands' earnings last year came out of the emerging markets. 30% of their earnings came out of China. Yum Brands, in my view, outside probably owning the Pilbara iron ore operations, is the single best exposure you could have to China. That is an almost a sure bet of making money. They've got 3,100 restaurants in China at the end of the last quarter. Most of them are all KFC, about 2,800 KFC stores. They earn 50% returns on their capital in China. Just because there's a lot of economic growth, and Chris, Tim Farrelly was saying this, just because there's lots of growth doesn't mean you're going to make money out of the growth. That's right. China's like bees to a honeypot at the moment. There's heaps of people in China and heaps of Chinese businesses and heaps of them making any money at all. You want to actually find the businesses that are actually going to make money and prosper from the tailwind of the growth they have. Yum Brands, from 3,000 restaurants today, their plan is to roll out between 15 and 20,000 KFCs in China over the next 10 to 15 years. it's quite incredible. Procter & Gamble, which is the world's, I think, best, is completely out of favour at the moment. I'm salivating with the point of what people are doing in this market. Procter & Gamble is trading at 20-year low multiples. It has 35% of its revenue coming out of the emerging markets already today. They're virtually number one in every one of their major categories in every country in the world, including China. Today, when you go through their brand portfolio, they have nearly 40% of the Chinese shampoo and conditioner market, and they own Head & Shoulders, Pantene, Wella, Herbal Essences, a brand called Aussie. They have 70% by value of the men's disposable razor market globally, and they just happen to have nearly 50% of the Chinese market, and they own Gillette. They're the worldwide market leaders in moisturiser products and mass market. They own Olay, and what's the number one brand in China by a factor of four? Olay. They're the world's largest player in disposable nappies in a brand called Pampers. Who's the market leaders in China's in disposable nappies today? P&G. They're worldwide market leaders in women's sanitary products. They own Tampax and other products. Who are the market leaders in China? Procter & Gamble. They're the market leaders in Brazil and Russia and most other countries. They're the worldwide market leaders in laundry detergent. They're not present in this market in that category, but they're massive market leaders. They've got 60% of the US market in laundry detergent. It's quite a remarkable position. And this company is trading at like 12 times PE at the moment. It is absolutely crazy for what this company should grow at over the long term. I'm talking about a company that's going to grow at 15% per annum. I'm talking a company that's probably going to grow its revenues 5 to 7% per annum and then get some operating leverage and everything else and continue to grow their EPS at satisfactory rates. So that's Procter & Gamble. Nestle is the world's largest food company in the world. That's 35% emerging markets. These companies have been there for decades. Nestle's been in China for 130 years. And when you have a look at the products they're in, they operate in every country in the world outside of North Korea. And somebody who told me when I was giving a speech, they said, well, I went to North Korea and I bought a Kit Kat. So maybe they're in North Korea as well, but maybe in a limited product range. But they're across a very, very broad spectrum of products. And you have Unilever, which is a company based, it's a Dutch Anglo company. It's across food and household products, so there's a bit of an amalgam between P&G and Nestle. 45% of their revenues are currently out of the emerging markets. They're by far and away the largest consumer products company in India today, with a fantastic position in India and in Latin and South America. P&G is very strong in Latin and South America, as Nestle is as well. But they own things like Magnum ice creams and Lipton iced teas, and they own Surf and Omo. And they're the world's largest deodorant company, so they own Rexona and they own Lynx and Axe and a whole series of brands. They're the world's largest margarine and spread company, and they own Continental. These companies, their brands are unbelievable. I was recently buying Unilever at 8 times last year's earnings. 8 times last year. There's all these Muppets are moving in to buy all these cyclical sort of discretionary crappy companies, and these things are sitting here at 8 times earnings, which you can literally sit on your ass for the next 15 years and actually watch the world go flatline, and I believe easily beat 9% per annum in this type of portfolio. As it extends longer times, that will get harder to easily beat, but where these companies are trading, McDonald's, probably no one's ever heard of this company. It's this funny company with an M, and they produce food, and I'm not sure if they've come here. But they've gone around the world. They've rolled out a few restaurants. They make a few hamburgers and they sell chips and do some other things. I know it's a hard concept to get. It could be an M-shaped company. Most people have tipped it upside down, haven't they, and called it a W, but maybe we're dependent on the M-shaped recovery. I think that's a very good analogy. But they have 40% of their business in emerging markets at the moment. Coca-Cola, which I'm actually going to present, so I won't go through it, but Coca-Cola is a remarkable business that's trading at a 20-year low in terms of its multiple of its earnings, and I think goes close to the most resilient franchise on the planet today. Danone is a French food group that is 39% of their revenues. They're in the world's largest yogurt producer, the world's second largest mineral water producer. They own Evian and some other brands, very strong in some major emerging markets. And they're into medical nutrition and also infant formula, two businesses that Nestle is actually very large in as well. And we own a few other businesses that people probably haven't heard of called Colgate, that make some toothpaste around the world. They actually have nearly 50% market share globally in toothpaste. It's quite a nice place to be in. 45% of their revenues come out of emerging markets today. And we own a smaller position in L'Oreal that's 30% owned by Nestle, that's the world's leading cosmetics company.
And what about the health stocks? Are they going to hang in
there
while low growth?
Health is a very interesting question, which we're doing a lot of work into health. Obviously, we've got an ageing demographic occurring around the world, and you know this lines on an emerging market sort of demographic, but health demographic of ageing populations is something very, very interesting. And we've done a lot of work so far in pharmaceuticals and medical devices and other areas. We're struggling a bit in health at the moment. It's so dependent, particularly on US government policy, in relation to they earn extreme margins in these businesses, and depending on where health policy goes, you can actually dramatically affect the earnings profile of these companies. So as I said earlier, growth per se doesn't necessarily translate into a fabulous earnings line, but you know we did a year of work on pharmaceutical stocks and threw it in the bin at the end. We're doing more and more work in that area because aging demographics is something that's quite obvious in many of these economies. It's not so obvious that you're going to make a lot of money. Some people said you just go and buy funeral homes and then you don't have to worry about it. And that's not completely stupid. Private equity's gone there in a big way. And we own some other stocks that are doing things for other reasons that we think are reasonably well protected if the world turns out to be low growth. What I tell you, if the world doesn't turn out to be low growth, all these companies will get re-rated to higher multiples than they would otherwise go. You know, you're not going to have Coca-Cola trading on 13 times earnings if the world turns out to be a high growth world. What I will very quickly talk about, just to try and put into illustration, Coke's probably our third largest or fourth largest investment we hold at the moment. When you have a look at it, most people think, oh, this is US centric. You can see from here of their earnings in 2008, only less than 20% of their earnings came out of the United States of America. 50% of their earnings and 50% of their volumes already come out of the major emerging markets. And if you heard from Mutnar Kent, he's saying we ain't even started in the emerging markets yet today. So this is an incredibly global business with an incredible brand position, with their per capita consumptions at very, very low levels at the moment. And when you look what they're doing, they are serving every single day. This is slightly out. Over 20 million outlets around the world are serving their products every day. They've got over 10 million installed fridges in the world, and now it's up to this was done last year, but they're now serving the equivalent of 1.6 billion cans of their product every single day. 1.6 billion. Last year, they grew that volume by 5%. And during the first quarter of this year, they grew it by 4%. So here is a company who is growing at 1.6 billion at 3-5% per annum. It is remarkable just how global and how penetrating this company actually is around the world. I don't think this can ever be replicated again. And if you have a look where they are over two times the size of PepsiCo. We actually own PepsiCo as well for a different reason. But they're virtually number one in all their categories. Outside sports drinks, where Gatorade's the number one brand around the world that's actually owned by Pepsi, they own Powerade, and they're the number three in packaged water around the world after Nestle and Danone, believe it, that we also own. But if you go into the emerging markets and you go into the BRIC economies, they're nearly three times the size of their nearest players in these huge markets around the world and internationally outside the United States. Look at the gap they hold over their newest competitor. This is just an enormous industry. Coca-Cola believes they are in the best business in the world that has one of the highest growth rates of any consumer product segment in the world. Of course, they're across many categories. Carbonated soft drinks that have sugar have zero. It doesn't have sugar. But the ones that have sugar, of course, they're declining in many of the developed markets. But their share of what people put into their mouth stays. They keep taking more market. Keep taking more market share. This is just showing per capita consumption. I think they bathe in Coca-Cola in Mexico. You know, people are nearly drinking two cans of the product per day. You know, it's quite staggering. But they actually say you don't believe that some of these markets, per capita consumptions can go up. You need income like the United States or a culture like the United States. And they just say, when in countries like Brazil and Mexico, the per capita consumptions are well above their global averages. And when you have a look where they are in India and Russia and China and places today, these major growth economies, the per capita consumption of their products are still very, very low. So Coca-Cola says, we have got 20 or 25 years of a runway for growth ahead of us that's almost guaranteed. And there's not many businesses you can think about. You may not think 3-5% volume growth is that exciting, but if the world's going to virtually flatline and these guys are going to start growing their revenues at rates we think are very acceptable, and the returns they earn in their business, it's actually a very, very good place to have your money. And there's nothing like this in Australia. You cannot buy a business of this type of dynamic on the Australian Stock Exchange. Coca-Cola, Amatil's a fairly good business, but this is a way, 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 way better business. And Coca-Cola, Amatil's trading on a higher PE multiple than Coca-Cola Atlanta is. And go and work that out. It's a hard one. This is in China, and I find this quite staggering. China today, they are virtually not earning much money. They are massively investing into China today. They are serving over 100 million products per day in China at the moment, Coca-Cola. And you saw that per capita consumptions were very, very low. So based on a 250-day year, that's close on 25 billion servings a year. So it's quite material. And when you have a look what they're doing is they're opening new retail accounts over 300,000 a year. 250,000 coolers they're placing in a year. They are spending massive amounts of capital putting coolers in, opening accounts, distribution to dominate this country in the next 25 years. And they're doing this in every big market around the world. And in their current earnings of Coca-Cola, China virtually is non-existent at the moment because they are building this with a long-term view in mind. And when I say, do I want to have a business that is going to win in China over the next 25 years and participate in emerging market growth? And when you think about them, that their volume last year grew at nearly 20% in China. That's a pretty satisfactory rate, especially when you're talking about 100 million per day. Of course, that growth rate will come down, but this is going to turn into a very, very large business for Coca-Cola, and I think they are almost guaranteed to make a lot of money in that business. So I think this is an incredibly powerful opportunity, and if you looked across Procter & Gamble and Yum Brands and some others, they have amazing businesses in China. In China today, and they're going to earn very, very good returns. And if they own their bottler in China at the moment, eventually they're going to spin out their bottler in China, in my view, and that bottler is going to be worth an enormous amount of money when Coca-Cola eventually sells that business and lists it in Shanghai or Hong Kong or something in 5 or 10 years' time, and suddenly people are going to wake up and go, oh my goodness, they've got a business that's only worth $30 or $40 billion, that no one had really factored in that much, or they certainly haven't factored in the current share price. Now, does this business earn a lot of cash? You can see that they have, over the last 9 years, they've grown their cash flow at 9% per annum. So, you know, a rate that is a very, very satisfactory rate, and this is actually from Coca-Cola. They're forecasting over the next 5 years to generate cash from operations between $41 and $45 billion. It's a staggering amount of money, and they're talking about their free cash flow after all their cash expenditure of almost $6 billion a year in free cash flow every year. I expect they're probably going to beat these numbers because they typically don't put it out. And this money, what are they going to do with this money? They predominantly give it all back to the shareholders, either as dividends or share repurchases. And we heard Bill Gross was saying that he thought it was very, very satisfactory for people to be getting 4.5% return on bonds, I think was his number this morning, that he's going into bonds at 4.5%. I can tell you Coca-Cola is currently giving you a free cash flow yield of nearly 7% at the moment. So he's saying buy bonds at 4.5%, it's a good place to put your money. You can put your money into the Coca-Cola bond, which I think is pretty low risk, give you 7%. His bond's not going to grow at all. A bond doesn't grow. I think this is going to grow 8, 9 or 10% per annum, that free cash flow yield for the next 25 years. I think I know, and I think I know where to put my money. This is much, much better than owning US Treasuries. There is just no comparison. Procter & Gamble's on an 8% free cash flow yield at the moment. If you really think about what the free cash flow to equity holders after all capital expenditure, you're getting about 8%. You know, long-term bonds in the United States are 3.5% at the moment. I'm not sure which bond he bought at 4.5%. I haven't seen. Maybe he's bought a 30-year bond or something. I don't actually agree with him on that point. I think buying bonds at 4.5% is going to be a killing field in the next 4 years. But we'll see who's right over time. These are the metrics that the Coca-Cola put out of what they're aiming for over the long, sustainable term. They're talking about growing their volumes at 3 to 4%. Remember, they're growing last year at 5%. They're currently growing at 4% during the biggest crisis known to man. We saw the per capita consumptions in all these countries still very, very low. They're penetrating those countries. Because they're the bottler, they actually sell the syrup to all their bottlers around the world, and they actually get a bit of inflation. They actually get some pricing power, so they're saying they can grow their revenues probably at 5 to 6%. They get some operating leverage. They're saying maybe their operating income is at 6 to 8, and their earnings per share in the high single digits. And I think these are very, very realistic long-term targets for Coca-Cola, and we're very comfortable at its current price. Coca-Cola's forecast to earn about $7.5 billion after tax this year, and it's trading at less than 14.5 times earnings. It wasn't that long after the dot-com boom, Coca-Cola was trading at 60 times earnings. It's now trading at a discount to the S&P 500. And as all people are selling out of things like this and putting their money into home improvement businesses and all these domestic businesses around the world and cyclical stocks and everything else. And I know exactly why they're doing it, because I know markets move like that in when we're coming out of recession, and people typically go into that area. Maybe everyone believes in the consensus view of the world that economic growth is going to be much lower, and they're all brilliant, smart people who are going to jump off the merry-go-round and sell their investment to some other sucker who's going to buy this business that's going to underperform. And I just say, we're not in that game. We want to, over the medium to long term, deliver plus 9% returns. And if they're clear and they're obvious to us buying them today, we buy them today, and we're not going to go sucked into the merry-go-round system. And there's a lot of fund managers that I'm hearing that effectively giving the exact same view of the world that I would be giving. But I actually look at their investment portfolios and I can't connect the dots. And the reason I don't think I can connect the dots is because I think people are so terrified about what their short-term relative market returns are going to be. That coming out of recessions, consumer staples typically underperform. And therefore, people typically don't want to buy these things at the moment, because in the next 6 months, this sector could underperform. To me, it's fantastic if people think like that, because I actually want to think about what I can deliver for ourselves. As Matt said, we've got $75 million of our own money invested in these funds. I'm trying to think about what the return on our money is going to be in the next 5 years. The next 6 months is, you know, these companies haven't even reported their earnings, you know. Who cares what the... these will do okay, you know. These are very low risk. If we have a market correction, these things are where everyone will flock back into. And
consumer staples, what debt ratios are
they? Well, a lot of these companies are between... A lot of these companies are A-plus to AA rated. I know people may not think much about ratings, but there is very low financial risk. These companies are producing, typically their free cash flow after capex and interest and everything else is 90-plus percent of their reported earnings. These companies are literally drowning free cash flow every year. And that's a remarkable thing about them. Because they're consumer franchises, their returns on their capital are very, very high, and they're actually not that capital intensive. And typically their gearing ratios, you know, most of these companies would pay off their debt with less than 2 years free cash flow if they chose to do so. So they're in very strong positions. And some of the other businesses, we own a business, people probably saw Google. Google's got $19.6 billion in cash at the moment and no debt. So we want to be at the low risk end of the spectrum. We don't think, outside American Express that we hold, there is no significant leverage in any company we own in the portfolio. Those were my formal remarks. I'm delighted to either take comments on this or to actually answer comments around the
around the world. I think David's going to moderate. I need to have a super Coke Zero to... Not even I can help the volume rates on this.
There's a few of us that are going to be in China next week. I'm sure we'll keep the run rate going. But look, I mean, that's been...
Drop into KFC while you're there.
That's been fascinating. Could we thank Hamish for a great presentation? We've got 10 minutes, so let's have some questions.
You talked about connecting the dots, saying you've got this low-return world. What does one pay for the privilege of being involved in the portfolio?
Pay in terms of what?
Well, what's the charge?
What's the charge to the client? We charge, maybe I should get back to talking about it. Our base management fee is with administration is 1.36% on the fund. So it's sort of in the middle of, I think, of where active global equity managers.
The expense ratio?
The expense ratio. 1.36.
And is there a performance fee anywhere involved?
There is a performance fee. What we have is a performance fee which is relatively unique, I think. We have a performance fee that's 10% of the excess returns, but we have to effectively beat three different benchmarks. We have to beat the MSCI and A-dollars, so we have to beat the index. But we also have to beat the absolute return on the 10-year Australian government bond rate in the year, and we've got a high watermark. So last year we beat the market by 23%. We beat the bond rate, which was about 6%, because we did plus 7 point something after fees last year, but we were we didn't beat the high water mark, because our high water mark is the unit price when we first established it, which was $1, and we're not quite above $1 because we paid out 5 cents in distribution, nearly, or 4 cents in distribution, and it wasn't above the dollar, so we didn't get any performance.
And then you start all over again in the next year.
No, we don't. We only know that the high water mark is still the high water mark. Until we're above $1, we can't. That's it. Yes, but the next year we have to beat the government bond rate and the.
Have a chat with Matt. Matt will be very happy.
Matt will
take sort of question.
That.
Next question. Yeah.
One question I always get from clients about international share funds is we're buying all these companies that produce EBT free cash, but they actually never get it. So what sort of yield will it actually throw back to us? And the other thing they say is the currency. Yeah, your performance is terrific, but are we going to lose any currency because the US dollar is going to go up?
Okay, well, you've asked a very, very broad, and too important questions. In terms of the dividend yield, they don't have imputation systems in offshore markets, so there's a tendency to pay out a much lower proportion of their earnings as dividends, because it's very inefficient, because they get taxed twice when you're a shareholder. So they tend to have lower dividend yields. And let's say these companies typically have a dividend yield of 3%, and we have a 1% management fee. Our yield on our fund's been running at about 2%. Okay, and that's probably a realistic sort of yield that you'll get out of global equities. But the extra 5% that the companies have in free cash flow in these companies is typically going to buying back their shares, which reduces their share count and accelerates their earnings per share in the future. So you tend to make the difference up with these companies. You get it through the share count and the earnings per share in the future, because they are returning the money to shareholders. They're just choosing to do it in a way that we don't really appreciate, because we have an imputation system where it's more efficient to pay out the franking credits than it is in offshore markets. The currency question, I think, are two very... I'll split into two parts, because I think currency is... We are an unhedged currency fund, and the reason we are unhedged predominantly, and I think it makes some sense, is we're trying to be relevant for your investment portfolios, and the vast majority of international equities ends up in an unhedged form in terms of how you collectively have all decided to set your investments. We're relatively agnostic on the point on currencies, but it is almost where the market is, we have gone to where the market is. And there is actually some reason from a diversification point of view. When the world goes to custard, we've got a pro-cyclical currency, the A dollar tends to go down, and you actually get an offsetting benefit to the falling share prices. So having some unhedged exposure in an asset allocation sense, I think actually does make some sense, and you have to look at your asset allocation holistically.
So, of course, recently we got a big benefit when the currency collapsed, and the volatility of this fund, I think during the whole financial crisis, was no more than 10%. There was only about a 10% movement in this fund over the whole period of the crisis, and part of that was the currency cushioning we got. But some of the rally we've seen since March, even though we've sort of been in line with the market since March, some of it hasn't been as much as you would headline, because the currency's gone from 63 to 83 cents. So over that period, it's been a very rapid ascent. So I think it really comes to an allocation question and construction, and the moment the market's largely unhedged in global equities, I think for some right reasons. But if people wanted a completely hedged version and the market's sophisticated, you could well find us launched a hedged version of the same product. We just don't think the market's sophisticated enough to take those things. So it's not our call, sort of, what we're putting out there in currency. The second one, you effectively made a statement, the US dollar is stuffed, I think was in summary of what you said. And what I find interesting is, and Bill Gross was sort of saying the US dollar is stuffed as well, but a lot of people make an absolute statement about a currency, which is actually a relative statement. A currency is only a relative point between two variables. And if you say, is the US dollar, what is the US dollar stuffed against? And people give the reason they're stuffed because they're going to lose their reserve status, what their current account deficit is and what their budget deficit is, and it's a stuffed currency. And you say, is it going to be stuffed against the pound? And people go, oh no, the pound's far more stuffed than the dollar. You say, is it going to be stuffed against the yen? And they say, no, the yen's days are over. And then they say, is it going to be stuffed against the euro? And people go, well, I can't possibly get my mind around the euro, I have no idea. Stuffed against the renminbi? Absolutely, because the renminbi is undervalued and should appreciate. Stuffed against the A dollar? Now, in the short term, we've got momentum, the risk trade's on. I think it's very, very difficult to call, because many of the issues why people are saying the US dollar's stuffed, from a current account deficit point of view, Australia's in a worse position than the United States is. We're in a better position in the short term because of the commodity issue we've got in this country in a risk trade, because we've got a higher interest rate differential than the United States, and we have to always have a higher interest rate differential, otherwise the dollar will get stuffed. But I think it's very difficult to make absolute statements about things that are relativities. And look, at 85 cents, I just don't have a view. If the currency was at much higher, much lower levels, yeah, I'd probably have a view, but I don't at the moment.
Thank you.